Hello everyone. From Glenmont Partners from Nuveen, this is Glenmont's Insights. Here we discuss all things energy transition, from policy to markets to technology. With assets in multiple geographies and nearly 4 billion of assets under management, we are one of Europe's largest fund managers focusing exclusively on investments in clean energy infrastructure. To find out more about us, visit glenmont.com. Welcome to episode 2 of Glenmont Insights. I'm your host, Fabian Davola, Head of Asia for Glenmont Partners from Nuveen. And today we will talk about the very hot topic of hydrogen and its role in the global economy. I cannot think of a better guest than Professor Nigel Brandon. Professor Brandon is the Dean of Engineering at Imperial College London and the Director of the UK Hydrogen and Fuel Cell Hub. He's also chairing the Sustainable Gas Institute. Nigel is also the founder and former CEO of Ceres Power, a UK-listed fuel cell company, and he has recently founded RFC Power, a startup with a new flow battery technology. Nigel, welcome to Glenmont's Insights. It's a real pleasure to have you here, and we'd like to start discussing the need for hydrogen in the global economy. Renewables had a remarkable rise in the last couple of decades, with both solar and wind costs coming down significantly and becoming competitive in some places with fossil fuels. Lithium-ion batteries have also improved significantly. However, in a net-zero economy, it doesn't look that we will be able to do everything with electrons, and we will need molecules to decarbonize certain sectors of the economy. I can think of heavy road transport, heavy industry, shipping, aviation, or seasonal storage. These are hard to decarbonize with electricity. Can you please explain why these sectors cannot be fully electrified, and approximately what percentage of the energy mix do they represent?
Well, okay, thank you very much. So it is indeed the case that there are going to be some sectors that are going to be very hard to decarbonize with electricity alone. And I think there are probably two main reasons for that. If we're looking at the transport areas that you've highlighted, so longer distance transport, long distance shipping, aeroplane flights, just the amount of energy you need to store in the battery on the vehicle really means that even with the advances that we've seen in lithium-ion batteries, and even, to be frank, with the advances that we may see yet to come, I really struggle to see that you'll carry the right amount of energy within the sort of weight possible or the volume possible. So I've signed it really, I cannot conceive of a world in which one can fly, you know, hundreds of passengers across the Atlantic from Europe to North America, for example, or from Europe to Singapore on electricity alone. You know, there are going to be areas where we have, you know, perhaps it's not quite so clear, and perhaps, you know, smaller trucks is an area where perhaps they could be electrified, depending on how battery costs and energy density advance, versus carrying the fuel as a molecule. So that's an area, that's a sort of technological battleground, if you like, as to see which way we go. But for some of these applications, it's really hard to conceive of doing it without a molecule. So then the debate is, what's the molecule?
And that leads me well to my next question. With a renewed interest in hydrogen recently, what makes hydrogen and molecules made from hydrogen the perfect partner for renewable energy?
Okay. Well, it all really comes down to efficiency and cost. And I think the first thing to say is, as we've already highlighted, if you can electrify, that's what you should do, right? So if you can use electricity to deliver the decarbonized electricity to meet the functional requirement, then that's the first thing to do. Because every time we want to turn that electricity into something else, we're going to pay a cost penalty, both for the equipment to do so, and there's an inefficiency in that process. So the easiest thing to make from electricity is hydrogen by splitting water. And that's why hydrogen is the next choice. We can talk in a bit, I'm sure we will, about this sort of technologies we might use to use that. But nonetheless, you know, you can use an electrolyzer and take that electricity and turn it into hydrogen. Now, having made hydrogen, it may be for some applications that's still not what we need. And we perhaps can discuss why that is. But hydrogen is a tricky molecule to store. And so for some applications, again, it may not be quite the right choice. In which case, we might choose to make something else from it. And you can make ammonia from it. You know, currently we make ammonia from natural gas, primarily, and it requires a lot of energy and it produces a lot of CO2. If we have a hydrogen stream, we can use that as a precursor to make ammonia. or we can take combine that hydrogen with CO2 if we can sequester or capture that CO2, and then we can start to think about making synthetic fuels, so synthetic liquid fuels. But every time we go down that chain, we're paying a cost penalty and we're paying an efficiency penalty. And so there are choices then about how far down the chain you go. The further you go to liquid fuels, the more convenient the fuel, but the more expensive the fuel. And so we're moving down, if you like, a chain from electrons to hydrogen to ammonia, perhaps, or methanol, to synthetic liquid e-fuels, as they're called, which is a range of things. So there is a choice there, right, about where you and where one goes in the trade-offs.
That's very clear. Thank you. But one of the main issues with green hydrogen has been its high cost. Currently, it's approximately $3 to $5 per kilogram, depending on the cost of the underlying renewable electricity. Still significantly more expensive than gray hydrogen. Where do you see the main cost reduction opportunities, and when would you expect it to become competitive with gray hydrogen?
Okay, so I mean, you're absolutely right to point out that the primary input cost to green hydrogen is the cost of the renewable power or the zero carbon electrons. 60 to 80% today of the price of that cost is a power cost. So obviously the cost of green hydrogen very much depends where you're making it and producing it. And there are certainly regions of the world where renewable power is lower cost, and that will give you the cheaper green hydrogen. It's also the case that it's then next most sensitive to the cost of the electrolyzer and, of course, the efficiency of the electrolyzer. And I think it's important to remember that really electrolyzers are still a nascent, relatively speaking, nascent technology. They're commercially available, but they're not truly produced at a global scale. The only technology in this kind of landscape of electrochemical technologies produced at a world scale is the lithium-ion battery. You know, and I observed the price down. You know, we've seen learning rates 20% for lithium-ion batteries, and I don't see why you couldn't see similar learning rates in other electrochemical technologies if capital was deployed at scale to manufacture. So I do think there's enormous cost down potential on the capital as well, so just to note that. So in terms of the relative cost, well, because it's a hard thing to compare green with grey hydrogen. Grey hydrogen has a carbon footprint, and the whole purpose of making green hydrogen is to abate those carbon emissions. And on price alone, I think that's always going to be a tough battle. Obviously, the price difference is most marked where renewable electricity costs are high and natural gas prices are low, because natural gas is the primary source of grey hydrogen. Of course, it's also made from coal with very high carbon intensity. But let's really compare it to natural gas. So your cost differential depends on those two things. So in perhaps parts of Northern Europe, where currently gas prices are high and renewable prices, well, perhaps say Southern Europe, say where gas prices are high and renewable costs are low, then you might start to see a closing of that differential. But I do think the landscape has shifted with the recognition with the war in Ukraine of the impact on both the resilience and supply of some of these carbonaceous feedstocks, and the desire of governments to become less reliant on that. And the recognition that hydrogen has a role to play in an important part of the role to play in the future energy system, and the recognition that there is value to be obtained potentially from making hydrogen and selling it to others, and therefore generating not only a decarbonization opportunity for that region, but the opportunity to generate revenue for that regional or country. So I haven't really answered your question because it all depends, but the sort of macro drivers on the economics are really down to the renewable power availability and the local natural gas prices. I mean, I've just returned from a trip to the UAE and Oman, which are doing an enormous amount on hydrogen now, or starting that journey. And that's not because they don't have natural gas and oil, but it's because they're trying to think about the future of their countries and what those markets will be as the demand for natural gas and oil goes down, which is the direction of travel for sure. Even if it doesn't go to zero, the demand will fall. And of course, there are countries used to providing molecules, so they're looking at it as an opportunity for continuing to have an energy business, essentially. So yeah, it's right today that green hydrogen is, you know, remains a relatively expensive option, but there's every expectation that those price points will come down
and we'll have to see where natural gas prices go.
And we have certainly seen a shift in sentiment, not just in Europe, but also in some Asian countries that relies on imports of LNG. Countries like Korea and Japan that traditionally have trade surpluses have seen this evaporated in just a few months due to the higher price of importing energy. Continuing on the cost side, it is a lot more cost effective to transport hydrogen via pipelines than on ships. However, hydrogen is a small molecule and can be leaky. Considering that in a net zero world, the gas network will not have a role to play, how feasible it is to use the existing gas infrastructure for future hydrogen transportation?
Yeah, it's a really important and somewhat sort of existential question for the gas industry at the moment, particularly in parts of the world, including where I'm based in the UK, where we have a very widespread natural gas distribution system. Technically, let's speak about it technically. You're right, of course, hydrogen is a small molecule. If you put hydrogen into a conventional gas distribution system without paying any attention to that, then it would be surprising if you didn't get leaks. And that's both a safety implication and an environmental implication, because hydrogen itself has a global warming potential, nowhere near that of methane, but it's not zero. What we find in the UK, and I speak to the UK experience, is that for a number of years now, we've been relining relatively old, low pressure natural gas distribution system, which is the natural gas pipelines that go to people's homes and buildings, rather than the national transmission system, which is a very high pressure sort of spine distribution. We've been lining those with sort of plastic liners, and we've been doing that to stop methane leaking. In fact, those liners also stop hydrogen leaking. So I think you can reline. You have to think about the composition. If you go with sort of plastic liners into conventional pipes, that will address that concern. Of course, it's still got to be done properly. And we do have a program of work and testing here in the UK to confirm that you can indeed get proper leak type systems. If you're building new pipes and new pipelines, of course, you can approach that. It's not a retrofit option. And then you can certainly go make certain that those are engineered correctly from the outset. I think there's a bit more of an open question around the high-pressure system and how one makes certain that it's not just the leakage of hydrogen, but also hydrogen can actually permeate into metals and create embrittlement. And that's not something we would want, and you have to pay attention to the alloys and so on that one uses. Now, we know how to do that. We've been doing it for years in the chemicals industry, but that's not to say that's the same metallurgy that's been used in high-pressure distribution system. So I think there's a bit more, at least in my mind, it's not my area of expertise really, but I think there's a bit more open question in my mind about the high-pressure systems, but the low-pressure systems, the distribution end, I think is, one could see a solution to making certain you can retrofit, but you do need to do something with the pipeline. You can't just use it necessarily as it is. You need to think about lining it, but there are many good reasons for doing that for what it's currently being used for.
And it doesn't seem like a particularly costly thing to do, right?
I think in the grand scheme of things, it's not the highest cost part of the process, right? So, one would have to pay attention to the end use technologies at the end of that pipe. So cooking and heating technologies. And of course, you've got to make the hydrogen in the first place and put in the capacity to do that. So it is a cost, but I think it's not the most significant cost element.
And moving now to your area of expertise, electrolyzers. What are the main differences between alkaline and PEM electrolyzers? And what are the main applications for each of them? What is the potential advantage of solid oxide electrolyzers? And what needs to happen for them to become fully commercialized?
Well, thanks for the question. So if we talk about alkaline electrolyzers first, and these are we've had alkaline electrolyzers for over 100 years. They're well established and a mature technology set, not developed, of course, for coupling directly with renewables. They've been really developed for making hydrogen as a chemical feedstock, much less commonly used to make hydrogen today because natural gas steam reforming has become taken over in many places, because gas prices were cheaper than using the electrical power to make the hydrogen. But now we're in it, as I said, in a different, we're looking at it for a different purpose. So alkaline electrolyzers, widely available at scale. You can go and get a turnkey 100 megawatt electrolyzer. They're the lowest cost form of electrolyzer today because they're also manufactured in volume and relatively mature. About 65% efficient in terms of the electrical work in to the chemical energy out in terms of hydrogen. Not recognized really for having good load following capabilities. They like to operate in relatively steady states. And that's because of the nature of the design inside the actual electrolyzer stack, which has porous membranes and can't really tolerate pressure differences. And those pressure differences are hard to avoid as things load from it quickly. Relatively high footprint, so they're quite big bits of equipment. They have quite a lot of balance of plant, so they need quite a lot of space. And so really best suited for more baseload applications. That's the first thing to say. And if you, but as I say, available at scale. And if you look at the world scale green hydrogen programs in Saudi or Australia, that's the type of technology that's being put in. Polymer membrane electrolyzers or PEM electrolyzers are a relatively newer technology, but are now commercially available at, you know, megawatt scale, 10, or even to 10 megawatt scale. They're more compact, so they run at a higher power density. That means the footprint's smaller. They need less balance of plant, so again, the footprint's smaller. A similar efficiency, around 65% or so. Much better load following capability, so much more likely to be able to be coupled to a renewable generator directly, and can produce hydrogen at elevated pressure. And so for some applications, that's a particular advantage. You don't have to have a compression stage, which is a cost and an inefficiency. So PEM electrolyzers, for me, are particularly well suited for things like vehicle refueling. And indeed, if you look at the, you know, the common forecourts with local hydrogen electrolyzers on there, there'll be PEM electrolyzers because they can reduce hydrogen at pressure and they're compact. So you are starting to see projects. There are projects in steel mills and other things with PEM electrolyzers. I have to say, personally, I see a world in which one has a mix of both, where you use the load following capability of the PEM coupled with the base load capability of the alkaline, particularly for large scale projects. Now, the disadvantage of PEM electrolyzers, today they're more expensive, and they do contain iridium and titanium and platinum and relatively expensive membranes. And iridium in particular is one of the rarest metals on Earth. And therefore does open up a question about the scalability of that technology to a truly global scale because of iridium supply. And there's quite a lot of platinum, far more platinum than in a fuel cell per unit area. So there's rare metals, which one has to be a little bit concerned about. So that's where the kind of pros and cons I see of the two technologies. Now, solid oxide electrolysis is very close to my heart. It's something I work on directly. It's a relatively new technology. We've known about the principles of it for a long time, but no one has really been developing it until fairly recently, really motivated by the interest in hydrogen and its production at green hydrogen. So in a solid oxide electrolyzer, these run at elevated temperatures, somewhere between 600 and 900 degrees centigrade, whereas the other temperatures, other technologies are low temperature, sort of well under 100 degrees C. Now, the high temperature gives you some advantages. The amount of electrical energy you need to put in to split water by electrochemistry in an electrolyzer goes down as the temperature goes up, and that's thermodynamics. So what this means is that you can put in less electricity, but with the balance of work you need to split water put in as heat. So if you've got a source of power and heat, you can get much higher electrical efficiencies. And if you can, even if you've only got low-grade steam available, the fact you haven't got to effectively vaporize water saves you a lot of energy. So high temperature electrolyzers are already demonstrated by companies like Sunfire at about 84, 85% efficiency. And there's no reason why you can't operate these devices into the high 90% efficiencies, depending on the balance of heat and electrical efficiencies, depending on the balance of heat and power. So that's their advantage. Disadvantage, well, they're not yet mature. People are starting to build, have built hundreds of kilowatts and are starting to build megawatt scale units. They're not really commercially available yet. They're more demonstration project available. And we have to, the lifetime is no reason to believe it can't be achieved, but it has yet to be really demonstrated. These high temperature devices have different failure mechanisms to low temperature devices. So one has to be absolutely comfortable that the lifetime can be delivered.
So it's a less mature technology, but has a lot of promise. And for me personally, I think high temperature electrolyzers, if they can be developed and manufactured at scale, will displace alkaline electrolyzers. They're more compact. They're ideal in a base loaded type application like alkaline. They're a lot more efficient and they'll be cheaper. There's a question there. And I should also add, there is also an emerging field of alkaline membrane electrolyzers, which will compete with PEM electrolyzers. And there are some companies developing those, question is demonstrating durability. But if that can come through, they will definitely beat alkaline membrane because they're much cheaper, don't have all the expensive metals in them. But they're still under, being developed.
Is it fair then to say that due to the reasons you mentioned and the faster response, PEM electrolyzers are more widely used with intermittent renewables or not necessarily?
Well, I think it depends on how directly coupled you need them to be. So if you look at the big green hydrogen projects in Australia and Saudi, they're alkaline electrolyzers. So you can either balance the intermittent renewables with, say, a large energy storage device or some other means, and then feed a constant power into the electrolyzer. Or you can take the more variable power directly into the electrolyzer, in which case the PEM electrolyzer would be better. So I think there's ways to think about integrating these. Or, of course, you could have a mix and you could manage some of the peaks with the PEM and the more base load with the alkaline. And it depends on the nature of the renewable power. So in some countries with a mix of solar and wind, you can actually also help balance that supply so it's not quite as variable. But if you've got a directly coupled, say, wind turbine to an electrolyzer, then it would have to be a PEM. But, as you go up in scale, there are other ways to think about that integration. But nonetheless, you've got to think about how you're balancing supply and demand.
Okay, so moving on to transport as one of the hydrogen applications. As vehicle size get bigger, hydrogen fuel cells become more attractive than electric vehicles. And you mentioned a little bit during the introduction. From what size do you see hydrogen vehicles taking over electric vehicles? And do you see any other molecules made from hydrogen, like ammonia or synthetic fuels, for some of these applications like shipping and aviation? I think you touched a little bit at the beginning, but maybe you can expand a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hot topic at the moment, right? This debate about transport fuel options, particularly for some applications, and I'll come to marine there in that sense. But if we're talking road transport first or land transport, it's really about the amount of energy the vehicle needs to carry. And obviously a larger vehicle will need more energy. But some applications also need more energy, right? So a long-distance truck obviously needs a lot more energy than something that's more designed for urban deliveries or short-haul. And when I talk to one of the major van manufacturers in Europe, these aren't necessarily very large vehicles. These are the sorts of vans that are commonly used for deliveries, but also for workmen. They say that about 40% of their customers don't think that the functionality they get with the battery electric version of that van, which is now commercially available, are satisfied and it doesn't meet their needs. That's because they need to do longer drives or they don't want the recharge time. So, I think it's that combination of range and amount of energy and the way in which the vehicle is used as well on the road transport side, right? So buses, for example, are a very good example where I think one can see hydrogen coming through. These are public good vehicles that they're used for public transport. Local air quality matters. They're refueled from a constant place, so you haven't got the hydrogen infrastructure issue. Same for fleets. I think fleets are much easier to put use on hydrogen than sort of individual vehicles because you don't need the mass hydrogen infrastructure rollout. So I think that those are areas where you can start to see. I think again, construction vehicles and things like that are heavy duty. And then certainly long distance trucking, I think, is the battleground. It's the big battleground. And for me, hydrogen there isn't necessarily competing with electricity. It's actually then it started to compete with other fuels like synthetic fuels. And then you come down to what will win. And it will come down to cost, right, and technology maturity. And I think there's a technology maturity battle at the moment about where things are going to go. And it's hard to know. Synthetic fuels are very expensive. I don't see ammonia being used in anything other than very professional, probably marine applications. It's highly toxic. I can't see people filling their trucks up with ammonia, right? I think it's just too hazardous and dangerous. So I think ammonia
is a carrier for, is potentially a fuel for marine, and there is certainly a lot of interest in maritime in using ammonia. But there's also a lot of interest in methanol, which you can also make from hydrogen. I think the challenge with methanol is it still has a CO2 footprint, and you really need to be absolutely convinced that you have a closed cycle on that CO2. So it's, I think it's a convenient intermediate, but I'm not certain it's an ideal one. It's also toxic and soluble in the water system. So I think when you look at marine, for me, I think I'm more of an ammonia person than I am a methanol person. You will certainly find some advocates for hydrogen for shipping as well. I think certainly inland waterways, I think hydrogen would work well. But again, there's a question around...
transportation. How easy it is to transport, right?
Yeah.
And presumably you're willing to pay the penalty in terms of cost and efficiency from hydrogen to ammonia, because ammonia is easy to transport over long distances. Is that correct?
That's correct. And so gaseous hydrogen has quite a low energy density. So if you're looking at, say, you know, like a Toyota Mirai hydrogen fuel cell car that has 700 bar hydrogen, with a high pressure hydrogen tank, but it's gaseous. If you're looking at moving that hydrogen from, you know, across an ocean, I think it's really hard to do with gaseous. So then you're talking liquid hydrogen. And liquid hydrogen is a big engineering challenge. That's not to say it can't be done. And there are certainly some big companies who are looking hard at trying to develop liquid hydrogen solutions. But it's then liquid hydrogen or ammonia, I think, as the vector for shipping it. And then you would crack the ammonia back to hydrogen at the point of call. So a bit like an LNG tanker, you know, would bring it on.
Right.
But the same perhaps with hydrogen. But that's it. You've got a liquid hydrogen or ammonia vector for moving that fuel. The question is, there's also the question of what do you run ships on, right? So there's a question of moving the fuel and trading it. So I think that's one question. And then you've got, what do ships power themselves on, whether they're a trader or moving goods around the world. And again, for me, I think ammonia, then that seems to be a debate between ammonia or methanol or a synthetic fuel. The ammonia will be cheaper than a synthetic fuel, because that's the most expensive option. And methanol, for me at least, is not the ideal, though you know, there are major shipping companies looking at methanol as an option made from hydrogen and combined with CO2. So there is a real debate at the moment about what's the future shipping fuel. And then if we come to the hardest area of all, which is aircraft and air travel, electricity is out, gaseous hydrogen is out. So it's either liquid hydrogen or probably synthetic fuels. And biofuels, of course, are an option as well. So, you know, this is probably the hardest sector to decarbonize. And therefore, if you're going to use these precious biomolecules for anything, that might be where you use them. But we also need those biomolecules for chemicals. So I'm not convinced that burning them is the right use of them. And synthetic fuels is maybe, you know, given the value of that fuel in that application, perhaps that's where synthetic fuels would go in. Certainly there are companies, and I'm advising one, we're looking at liquid hydrogen solutions for shorter haul, but nonetheless commercial aircraft. So, you know, flying from, you know, within Europe type journeys, whereas going again sort of across the Atlantic or from halfway around the world, you probably need to use a synthetic fuel for that, with a classical gas turbine. So there's a really set of open questions at the moment around all of these choices, right? There isn't an easy answer. And it's going to come down to a technology race, both from the fuel side, but also from the engine, you know, power conversion side, and how these two things work in harness together. But, you know, from all my dealings with companies and organizations, there's a limited number of games and options, but we're not quite certain where the lines are going to be drawn. What we do know is we can't do everything with electricity, so we're going to need some molecules.
And then the synthetic fuels for aviation, I would assume it is because it has the highest energy density.
Yes.
And therefore, you're willing to pay a higher price for that higher quality fuel, right?
You're going to pay a high premium for that energy density.
Exactly.
And for some applications, that might be. You know, I can see a world in the future, right, where we're driving cars on electricity normally. If hydrogen becomes really widespread and low cost, I could see that also being part of that mix, but I don't think it will happen until it's widespread and low cost. And people will be running their classic Aston Martins on synthetic fuel. So, and be prepared to pay, you know, $20 a litre for it, because that's what, cost, right? But it doesn't matter if you're running your classic Aston Martin on it. And if you're going to fly across the Atlantic, you'll probably have to pay a lot more money to do so. And you'll be either on liquid hydrogen or probably on synthetic fuel. But you might fly to the hub in Amsterdam or Singapore from a local, you know, in Asia, within Asia, on hydrogen, because it'll be cheaper than synthetic fuel. So therefore, it makes sense from a price point of view to do that.
Right. So moving on to heat. Heat is a difficult topic for decarbonization due to the large seasonal variations between winter and summer. These variations makes it very reliable in natural gas. What role do you see hydrogen playing in decarbonizing this sector?
This is almost a religious conversation rather than a technological conversation at the moment around heat. And the UK is where I am based, is absolutely at the heart of that, because heat is by far and away our largest contributor to our carbon emissions. Not only the heating of our buildings, but process heat as well. And 96% of it is from natural gas. And so you cannot continue to produce that heat with natural gas without abatement and have any hope to hit your net zero targets. And the other thing to say is that if you can use electricity to provide that heat, if it's coupled with a heat pump, that's a very efficient solution. So heat pumps produce somewhere in the order of 3 to 3.5 units of heat per unit of electricity. But they produce that heat at a relatively low temperature. And certainly in places like the UK, which is used to heating, has hydronic heating systems, so hot water running around buildings to heat it, you're used to a much higher temperature. So heat pumps, electric heating, make a huge amount of sense in new build, where you can engineer, they need high surface area heat exchangers. In other words, they put them under the floor, so underfloor heating, and a low return temperature to maximize the efficiency of the heat pump, and of course, well-insulated buildings. So that makes a lot of sense. But in retrofitting to old housing or building stock, which is the case in much of Europe and obviously in other countries as well, where we've got long-established housing or building stock, it's actually quite a difficult thing and an expensive thing to take that all with electricity and heat pumps. So the question then is should you force all homeowners and building owners to strip out their heating systems, put in new heat exchangers or radiators, and insulate all of their properties properly so that the heat pump works? And I actually find that quite a hard thing to think about how we would do in many democracies, including the one I live in. The other option then is to replace the natural gas, which is what we all use mostly, with hydrogen. Now, the disadvantage of doing that is that whereas you get three units or so of heat for 1 unit of electricity with a heat pump system, because making hydrogen is about 65% efficient and you've got some losses, you get about 0.6 units of heat for 1 unit of electricity, right? Mm. So that's quite a lot different.
Right.
So you need a lot more and renewable power to make the hydrogen if you're going to make it from renewable power. Now, you could also at this point think about doing blue hydrogen, which of course we haven't really discussed. So this is with CCS and CO2 capture from natural gas. So that's carbon, effectively natural gas, but abated. And that might give you more hydrogen at scale, separate conversation. But nonetheless, you're paying a penalty for the amount of energy you've got to put into the system to put that hydrogen down that pipe. But once it's down that pipe, the homeowner or building owner hasn't got to make major changes to their own infrastructure to use it. So you're trading off between, making it easier for the end user to utilize that low carbon source versus making it more expensive in terms of the amount of infrastructure you need to put in to deliver it. And that's therein lies the debate. What's the best thing to do? I just struggle to see how you can make consumers engage with having to make enormous changes. But from a sort of efficiency point of view, the electricity is better if you can engineer the changes you need in the built environment. But it's a really tricky one, actually.
A tricky one and a key one, in particular for some European countries, right?
A key one in certainly in places like the UK and the Netherlands, who are very big natural gas users. So countries that have come to rely on natural gas as an important source of heating, which isn't everywhere, it's a particularly tricky one. And I, you know, so my engineer says it should all be electricity, but my, with my own home at home,
right,
I worry about that. There are some combinations where you can think about heat pumps with some top-up gas heating. So, you know, a mixed hydrogen heat, so more heat pumps, but keep hydrogen in the mix is perhaps a pragmatic solution to doing that. And there are trials taking place in various places, including in the UK, on hydrogen for heat at the moment, making certain, of course, that it can be done safely, which is clearly, a, you know, which of course it can, but, you know, one needs to make certain that you can demonstrate it, train up all the gas engineers to work on hydrogen safely and so on.
Moving on to grid-scale storage, we know that as penetration of renewables increase, it becomes harder to balance the electricity system, and there is growing room for flexible technologies like storage. This could be in the form of lithium-ion batteries, flow batteries, or hydrogen itself. How do you see these technologies complement each other, and how would you use them based on the number of hours of storage required?
Yes, so thanks for that. Yeah, so we're talking about grid-scale storage now, and the ability to appropriately balance supply and demand. And of course, this arises and becomes more of an issue as we put more renewables onto a grid system and we take conventional thermal power plant off that system. So conventional thermal power plant has what's called inertia. So the turbines will keep spinning even if there's an interruption. So they can provide some short-term stabilization to the system. That's one type of storage. So, you know, seconds of storage just to manage disruptions to supply. Then you've got what might happen with outages or failures of particular points in the system, or cases where the wind isn't blowing quite when you want it, or obviously we know when the solar is not generating, in which case one needs to manage perhaps minutes to out, you know, perhaps an hour or two of storage. Now, for those types of applications, it's clear that lithium-ion type solutions, or you know, whatever the flavor of chemistry that's within them, and there are different flavors of lithium-ion batteries, they're pretty good now at providing those seconds to minutes to a few hours of storage. But as we need more and more periods of backup, so solar PV would be a good example. So obviously with high penetration of solar photovoltaics, there is no power generation at night. Now, whilst energy demand may fall at night, nonetheless, you've still got 8 hours or so that you need to think about backing up. So under those applications, then you might need sort of 8 to 10 hours of energy storage. And if you've got a conventional sort of lithium-ion type battery, which stores a kilowatt hour, so it gives you a kilowatt for an hour, and you need 10 kilowatt hours because you need a kilowatt for 10 hours, you need 10 times the amount of batteries. So it costs you 10 times as much, pretty much. So the price of those batteries scale linearly. Scales linearly with the amount of energy. Now, in something like a flow battery, in a flow battery works differently. In a flow battery, you store your energy normally in the form of a liquid, which you've changed the oxidation state of. And if you want 10 times the amount of energy, you need to store 10 times the volume of liquid. And volume doesn't scale linearly. Right? It's about tanks, for example, to store that liquid don't scale linearly. In fact, so they get cheaper, relatively speaking, as the amount of energy you need goes up. The ability to fill or empty that tank of your flow battery has something like a fuel cell or an electrolyzer, sort of combined unit in the middle of it, into which you put power or generate power. So that can stay fixed depending on the amount of power, and the energy scales non-linearly. So as you go up and up in energy, things like flow batteries, also some other technologies like liquid air, some form of compressed air technologies, will get cheaper.
And this is where RFC power comes in, right?
Yes.
Targeting this niche.
That's right. So RFC is a company the most sort of widely utilized flow battery utilizes vanadium in both liquid form in both sides of the flow battery. And vanadium, and obviously the cost of the flow battery as you go up in energy depends on the cost of the electrolyte, right? The liquid. And vanadium is quite expensive. So whilst I say it's scaling, it does scale differently. Nonetheless, it gets quite expensive. So it would be nice to not use vanadium. It's also available in parts of the world like Russia and China, which are not, perhaps not on top of everyone's list of suppliers. So we've invented a different type of chemistry. It uses manganese. Manganese is what's available in every kind of dry cell battery, you know, your Duracell type batteries. So it's widely available, very cheap. It's a tenth the price of vanadium. And then on the other side of the flow battery, we have a hydrogen, in fact. So it actually couples to a hydrogen economy, or you just have a low pressure hydrogen system of a few bar. And this is a tenth the price. So that's good. And we believe will give more attractive opportunities in that kind of 10 to 24 hour plus storage range. So that's what we have a company we set up 4 years ago, and that's in our Imperial incubator space and has 7 people working for it these days. So earned days, but we're excited about it.
Fantastic. It's really very, very clear. So I really like the way you put it. Before we close, I would like to mention briefly about the potential of hydrogen in Asia since I am based in Singapore. There are a number of countries in Asia that either do not have the renewable resource or they have a very high population density and are large consumers of electricity per capita. Therefore, it becomes very hard for them to produce all the green electricity they need and will need to import it from other countries. Singapore is certainly one, but I can also think of places like South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and others. And it happens that Japan and Taiwan are composed of islands, and South Korea is not connected to the Chinese grid because of North Korea. Therefore, they can't import green energy as electrons, and they will have to do it as molecules. And Australia is probably where green hydrogen can be produced at the lowest cost in the region. So a lot of hydrogen is expected to move from Australia to these countries. Finally, I'm going to ask you if there are any books, materials, or podcasts on hydrogen, in addition to your own videos on YouTube, that you would like to recommend to our listeners.
I mean, there's a wealth of stuff. There's a new industry group called Happy Hydrogen, which I rather like the title of, which people are welcome to go and have a look on. And there's a number of trade organizations and trade groups who are kind of advocates for hydrogen. I think it can be difficult. I mean, it tends to, you know, you find quite a lot of advocacy groups for hydrogen. And if I was to be slightly critical, sometimes they're a bit too enthusiastic of only the upside and don't address some of the downside issues. So, but nonetheless, those are good places to go and find out what's happening with the state of the technology and the state of commerciality. So they're interesting places to go and have a look. But just to temper that a little bit by some of the downsides.
Thank you so much, Nigel. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Sure. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
And that's it for this episode of Glenmont Insights. We hope you have enjoyed. Be sure to follow us and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. A big thank you to our guest, Nigel Brandon, for joining us today. And thank you for listening. Until next time.